the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Today we're going to have a very special edition of this program with an interview with Susan Jacoby, author and journalist, blogger. She's a fascinating person, and she's been on this program before. She and I have kind of squared off on some issues. She represents a secularist viewpoint. As she makes clear in this interview, she identifies herself not only as a secularist, but as an atheist. And so when I, as an evangelical Christian, am in conversation with her, it's always interesting because we have a fascinating exchange of ideas. What is also interesting, I think, is that when Susan Jacoby wrote a piece for the New York Times op-ed page just a couple Sundays ago, she cited me on the issue of faith-based programming because, well, let's put it this way. Sometimes it takes a secularist and an evangelical Christian to understand that we really do understand each other, whereas people in the middle sometimes, in a muddled middle, seem to miss the point. So you'll find this conversation interesting. It's going to come up in just a moment because this is a special interview format today. We'll not be taking calls, but I think you're going to find this interview with Susan Jacoby, the conversation to follow, very, very interesting. This is a special edition of the Albert Mohler Program. We are from Orlando, Florida, and there is a lot going on in the news. I'll tell you, the embryo is certainly front and center in the news. USA Today's editorial page from yesterday, Wednesday, March 18th, had a lead editorial entitled "The Right and Wrong Ways to Prevent Future Octomoms." Writing for the editorial page, the statement says, the case, that is the case of Nadia Suleiman, you remember having six and then eight, says the case, exceptional as it is, points to the need for safeguards to prevent it from being repeated. It there, meaning these multiple pregnancies, with especially IVF treatments. Carrying so many fetuses brings massive health risks to the mother and the children, and Suleiman's irresponsibility places a burden on society. The question is how to regulate IVF, and the octuplet case has already spawned one ill-conceived proposal at the state level and one potentially useful one. Well, what they're against here, the editorial page writers here at USA Today are against what happened in Georgia, where legislation in Georgia might identify the embryo as a biological human being and limit the number of embryos that could be implanted, and also state that all those that were fertilized, embryos that were created by fertilization of the egg in the laboratory environment did have to be implanted. So there are no leftover embryos, there are no spare embryos, and there are no more created than are going to be transferred into the mother's womb. USA Today doesn't like that. They accuse this of mixing this issue of IVF with abortion politics. This is their sentence. They say there is no need to complicate the Suleiman case by mixing in abortion politics, end quote. Well, this is where I have to take odds with the editorial page of USA Today. There's no way to talk about the embryo without talking about the abortion issue, because you're talking about an unborn human being here. And whether that unborn human being at the stage of development from the embryo to the fetus is in a laboratory or in a womb, the moral status of that unborn human being is what is at stake here. And we clearly have a problem with Nadia Suleiman's case. And the problem is very clearly the fact that the use of in vitro fertilization technologies has led to the development of moral quandaries we've never faced before. We've got hundreds of thousands of frozen human beings stored in IVF laboratories and fertility clinics. And now we have this, Nadia Suleiman, and now you have efforts to try to do something about it. The American Society for Reproductive Medicine, or ASRM, is the professional guild of physicians who are involved in reproductive medicine. They have certain procedures and guidelines. According to USA Today, these guidelines evolve along with medical knowledge and ethical debate, but the guidelines have no teeth. The only potential penalty is expulsion from the association. Now, Missouri is looking at the possibility of legislating those ASRM guidelines so that there's a penalty beyond getting kicked out of the guild, of the society. There's the penalty of losing one's medical license. USA Today says this approach has the virtues of being straightforward and simple. It's about protecting health and safety. It doesn't play abortion politics. If other states followed suit, the sad and unusual story of Suleiman would be less likely to be replicated. Well, a couple big problems with this. Number one, the guidelines of ASRM do not prevent the creation of and storage of and eventual destruction and disposal of genuine human embryos that are frozen in these fertility clinics. I have a big problem with that. So also, by the way, does Jill Stanek, who wrote the opposing column in USA Today. And to give USA Today, by the way, credit as a newspaper, it's one of the very few newspapers, in fact, probably the only newspaper I know that publishes along with its own editorial statement the opportunity for a rebuttal from someone on the other side. That's a pretty good example of at least the way this kind of journalistic conversation could and should take place. But Jill Stanek ends her line, ends her essay, I should say, or editorial, with the line that really gets to the heart of all of this. Listen to this. She writes, currently, sea turtles in the U.S. enjoy more procreative protection than women and children. Sea turtles have more procreative protection, that is, protection during the stage of reproduction, than women and children. And she agrees that the sensational story of Nadia Suleiman giving birth to octuplets in vitro fertilization has spotlighted the need to regulate what she calls this wild west of women's reproductive care. By the way, that's what the United States is being called routinely now in terms of international discussion, the wild, wild west of reproductive technologies because of the absence of law covering so much of this in the United States. And she goes on to argue here, the procedure to garner eggs for IVF is potentially dangerous to women. IVF is certainly dangerous to preborn humans. The American Society for Reproductive Medicine states that the, quote, live delivery rate, end quote, of these embryos is 31.6%. That means nearly 7 in 10 human embryos die in the process of IVF technology treatments. She goes on to write, usually 10 or fewer eggs are harvested and fertilized. The resulting unique human beings are grown in a petri dish and checked for defects. Suspected imperfect embryos are killed. Typically, the doctor will implant 1 to 5 unflawed embryos. Put unflawed in quotation marks if you think about it. If multiple survive, selective reduction is recommended. Remaining embryos are frozen. Some die when thawed. Others are killed in the name of science. Well, you know, all this just piles problem upon problem. Number one, you have the whole issue here of deciding which embryos are flawed and unflawed. By what criterion? And what do you do then with those that you declare to be thawed, flawed? You just destroy them. Now, what does that say about the dignity of every single human being? What does it say about our understanding of what it means to be human in the first place? And then, she writes, if multiples survive, selective reduction is recommended. Well, that's a euphemism. That's a term that avoids talking about what it really is. It's the targeted killing of some of the fetuses following medical advice that the surviving fetuses would have a better chance if there is more room and more resource in the womb for those fewer embryos, now fewer fetuses. So selective reduction is really just the targeted killing of unborn human beings. I'll give USA Today credit for putting both sides up. I'll also give USA Today credit for taking on the issue. It is an important issue. But I want to come back to the fact that as Christians look at an issue like this, we can't just decide to use human wisdom and say, all right, we have a problem. How can we kind of create a compromise that will enable us to get through this with the least amount of friction, the least amount of controversy, and the greatest amount of human happiness? We can't do that. We can't just look at this and say, where would human reasoning lead us? Because human reasoning would not lead us to understand the dignity and sanctity of every single human being, because every single human being is made in the image of God. So what we have here is a huge ethical challenge, and let me just remind you that once you begin to walk down the road that says, all right, we'll take human beings at some stage of development and say, this one's not so worthy of protection. This one we can use. This one we can harvest for body parts. This one we can use for stem cells. Then eventually you're on a very quick road to deciding, well, all right, the next step is to say we can create embryos specifically for this purpose. We can use the organs, as we talked earlier this week, taken from aborted fetuses. Before long, the logic will lead us to do other things that we consider right now untenable, unthinkable, and immoral. Meanwhile, William Salatan, writing at Slate, warns us of the shape of things to come when he tells us something we're going to look at in a subsequent program, and that is that in Japan, we now have at least one case of abortion when a mom came to find out that the embryo that was implanted within her wasn't hers, and so she aborted it because she wanted her own. Now they're not even sure that it wasn't hers, but what we have here is, again, the commodification of a human being. You have a human embryo turned into a thing to be bought, sold, stored, manipulated, destroyed, experimented upon, and in the end, either implanted and transferred or simply aborted because it doesn't meet muster. lots to think about. We'll be returning to these issues because intelligent Christians have to look at this and have to look at it honestly and squarely and understand what is really at stake. When we come back, we're going to talk about what's at stake and other arguments as well. Susan Jacoby is the author of The Age of American Unreason, a New York Times bestselling author. She's a blogger, and she's also a participant, along with me, at the On Faith program at the Washington Post and Newsweek magazine. It's going to be a fascinating conversation. You won't want to miss it. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Susan Jacoby is the best-selling author of books including Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism, and The Age of American Unreason. She's also the blogger at the Secularist Corner, the Washington Post, and you've probably seen her in the media as well. Ms. Jacoby, welcome to the Albert Mueller Program.
Very happy to be talking to you again. I follow you on Faith.
Well, I'm glad to be there with you. It's an interesting place for conversation, and so also is the New York Times. And I was very, very interested to see your op-ed piece a couple weeks ago in the New York Times dealing with President Obama's new Council for Faith-Based Programs. Why don't you just kind of tell us what your concerns are there?
Well, first of all, my concerns are, in one respect, the same as that they've always been about faith-based programs, which is that I think they're unconstitutional. I think that giving money to church organizations on the assumption that there is some way that they can separate their Christian or religious mission from a secular mission, which the government is supposedly paying for, is ridiculous. Now, Obama is not doing anything other than what he said he would do during the campaign. I didn't vote for Obama because I thought he agreed with me about faith-based programs. He's a person of faith, and he said he was going to expand faith-based programs, and that is what he's doing. In a way, I mentioned in the piece also that my concerns are from the secular side, but certainly there are many religious people, yourself included, on your own blog and on Faith, who have a lot of reservations about this from the opposite point of view. In other words, if I am misparaphrasing you, correct me, but what you have said is that religion needs to be free to perform its mission and not to be told by the government who it can hire, that it has to hire without regard to religion or whether it can proselytize or not. Is that an accurate reflection of what you said?
Oh, it is accurate, and as a matter of fact, that's why I thought this conversation would be really helpful, because I appreciated the way that you quoted me in your article, and you did so exactly in the way that made the point I would want to make. And
well, there are other religions that feel that way too, for different reasons.
Sure.
Most non-Orthodox Jews are opposed to all government aid for religious organizations for reasons that have to do with the historic status of Jews as minorities. And in fact, that is how the Baptist tradition started out, also being against government interference.
Absolutely.
With religion, because at the start of this country, Baptists were a minority and were up against established churches in the various colonies. But certainly there is a case to be made, and this is what I said in the piece, that I think your point of view, from the point of view of a conservative Baptist, is a lot more realistic than the point of view of the so-called religious left, which are people in the Democratic Party who aren't opposed to faith-based programs. They were just opposed to the fact that most of them went to very right-wing religious organizations. But it makes sense from a religious point of view that you can't separate your religious mission from a secular mission and say, well, this dollar is going for the secular job of this. But after all, if you're somebody whom part of your religious mission is to convince others of your point of view, in your case, convincing people that the way to salvation is through Jesus Christ, then it's not like you can cut yourself in two either. And, you know, say, here's the secular me that's doing this, and here's the non-secular me who's not going to do that. So I think the idea that there isn't going to be proselytizing and there isn't going to be discrimination in hiring in these programs is ridiculous. And well, that's why I'm opposed to them from a secular point of view, but I can easily see why people would be opposed to them from a religious point of view, too.
Well, I think the real potential in our conversation here today is really sparked by what we're looking at right here. From a point of a view of just mere honesty, I think it's rare that a secularist and an evangelical Christian in conversation are often even talking about the same things. And I really respect your writings, and you and I have had dialogue before, and I've appreciated that, and you've been on this program before,
right,
and I appreciate you coming back, because I want to come back and say, I think that you understand me. You understand an evangelical Christian better than those in some kind of muddled middle really understand, because you are right when you say that as an evangelical Christian, ultimately, my concern must be to see persons come to a knowledge of Jesus Christ as Savior. And I can't say...
Yeah, of course, or he wouldn't be an evangelical Christian.
Absolutely. So, you know, on that point, I think it gets to my concern about the faith-based program, and that is that the program wins over the faith, is that eventually evangelical organizations will be less evangelical. Christian organizations will be less Christian because of taking these government funds.
Well, my concern is the opposite, but if I were you, I would have your concern. My concern is the opposite. I think inevitably a lot of these programs deal with captive audiences. They deal with people in great need, people like prisoners, people like children whose fathers are in prison. They deal with people who need the services that are being provided. And therefore, I think that given the fact that the mission of proselytizing religions is to proselytize, I think it's just very easy to have these programs as an instrument of religious conversion, whether people mean it to be so or not. So I think that the idea that you can give government money to religious programs and not have that happen, I think it's ridiculous from a secular point of view. And I think the religious left is just fooling itself about this. They are saying that there is some way, what Obama's director, Josh Dubois, who is a Pentecostal minister, announced is all these programs would be, subjected on a case-by-case basis to the Justice Department to make sure that they weren't violating those non-discrimination and hiring conditions. Well, who's going to do that? How are you going to do that? It just doesn't make sense to me from either a secular or a religious point of view. And the other point I made is I think these programs are a clear violation of the First Amendment because they inevitably go to those religions that are wanting to accept this government money. In other words, they can't be equal because there are a lot of religions that don't want to accept this government money. So who it's going to are the slice of religious America that wants to accept this money. You know, there's something else also in this economy, which I didn't emphasize greatly, but I think it's important. Some of the strongest support for faith-based financing for the last 10 years has come from African-American churches serving very poor community. These are churches, whose financing reflects the poverty of many of the communities they serve. And there's something else about government money with these churches, too. What if they start to become dependent on this money, and then the next administration comes along, maybe doesn't like their programs, and yanks it out from under them? What happens to their church?
Well, that's a very legitimate point, and I think
again,
there are many, many issues.
Again,
here.
I'm taking the religious point of view, but it seems to me that the enthusiasm for this kind of financing just flies in the face of facts, and it flies in the face of facts as religious people know them as well as secular people.
I'm talking with Susan Jacoby. She's the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Age of American Unreason. We're going to turn to that book when we come back out of this break. And our discussion about the faith-based programs is a way of getting into a discussion Well, let's just see what happens when a committed secularist who's very honest about secularism and an evangelical Christian get into conversation about, what it means, for instance, to think rightly and to be an intellectual and to try to understand the truth. We'll be back. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Listening to the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmueller.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. My guest today is Susan Jacoby. She's the author of many works, including the New York Times bestseller, The Age of American Unreason, now revised and updated, new paperback edition. And Ms. Jacoby, I have to tell you, as I open your book, and I read it for a second time now that it's out in its revised edition, and I'm exhilarated by one of your sentences. You write, during the last 4 decades, America's endemic anti-intellectual tendencies have been grievously exacerbated by a new species of semi-conscious anti-rationalism feeding on and fed by an ignorant popular culture of video images and unremitting noise that leaves no room for contemplation or logic. End quote.
I'll stand by that quote.
Well, I'm going to stand with you on that quote. Now, where we go from there may be a bit different, but I have to tell you that when I read your book, about half of it, I have exclamation points beside paragraphs. We read a lot of the same people. We actually read the American culture along very similar lines. We would just have it go in very different directions, and that's why I really have been looking forward to this conversation. To put it bluntly, you see me really as a part of the problem. Well, evangelical Christians.
There are a lot of people I see as much more of a problem than you. Do I see literal interpretation of the Bible, which is something that literal interpretations of some of sacred books are something that about a third of Americans believe in. In most cases, it's the Christian Bible because that's the majority religion in our country. I do see literal interpretation of the Bible. That is, I don't see the belief that every word in the Bible is literally true, that the earth was created in 6 days and so forth, as compatible with modern science at all. I don't see, unlike my fellow atheists, and I'm not just a secularist, I'm an atheist, and I don't make any more claims, by the way, like in the battle, for instance, over evolution. I don't claim to know how the first piece of matter got started, only that evolution was the mechanism by which we got here eventually. But I no more know how the first piece of matter got started in the universe than the answer to how God got started. The answer in Catholic school is God always was, always will be, and always remains the same. Well, I don't find that a satisfactory answer, but I find the original question of who started God about equivalent to the question of how did the first bit of matter in the universe get started?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Well, and I understand that. I have to tell you, I'm with the nuns on the teaching about the nature of God. I think they got that exactly right. But I appreciate the fact...
It's not an answer. It's a proposition. God always was, always will be, and always remains the same. You know what to me as a secularist the most important line in the entire Bible is? It's in only one of the Gospels, in the trial of Jesus. And Pilate asks it. And you could say Pilate is definitely not somebody you want to emulate. But the question he asks is simply, what is truth? You mentioned truth at the opening of the segment. Well, I think one of the differences between the secular point of view and the religious point of view is I'm interested in looking for what I can find that can be shown to be true through various kinds of evidence. As for truth, I think that the spirit of that question is right. Well, what is truth? One man's truth is not another man's truth, which is why I never argue with anybody. There are all these debates about the existence of God. I can't imagine participating in those because they are two different, you know, views entirely. You're never going to prove to someone who believes in God that there isn't one, and I wouldn't presume to want to do that.
Well,
and
you're
never going to prove to someone like me that there is. Essentially, God is a matter of belief. It's a matter of faith.
Well, I would argue there's a little more to that. I believe that belief in God is a properly basic belief, without which, frankly, further thought becomes impossible. I also have to go back to Pilate for a minute and say the issue with Pilate was that he didn't know the truth. He just rejected it. But I really appreciate your honesty in this, and I have to tell you, when I read your chapter in your book, The Age of American Unreason, on the new old-time religion, I'm fascinated by your indictment of the way the cultural elites miss the fact that millions of Americans didn't go along with the game of secularization. When we come back, I'd like to ask Susan Jacoby about how she sees that. Also, she has a very interesting section in this chapter in which she really discusses the difference between moderate religion and what she calls fundamentalism. I think it'll be fascinating just to see how that plays out in terms of what she understands to be the future of American public life. Susan Jacoby is a best-selling author. She's also a blogger, a panelist at the Washington Post and Newsweek's Project on Faith. I'm glad to be a participant with her there, and I'm very glad she's on the program today. We'll be right back with more as you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I'm enjoying my conversation with Susan Jacoby, best-selling author of The Age of American Unreason, out in a very new paperback edition. Ms. Jacoby, there are three questions I just have to ask you as I read your book. One of them, you very correctly, I think, indict American elites for missing the fact that millions of Americans didn't go along with the secularization project.
Well, I wouldn't put it exactly that way.
All right.
I don't know what the quote secularization project is, but I think that, and I don't like the term the elites either. I always use it in quotes because
you did use it, I have to say.
But I've used it in quotes because
right.
I think the elites has come to stand for a certain thing, and it's actually you folks are the people who have defined the word the elites, meaning people who are intellectual snobs who go to Eastern universities. Barack Obama was called a member of the elites over and over again. Over and over again, I remember in the campaign we say he's never had a real job, as though being a constitutional law professor and a community organizer is not a real job. His job is as real as yours. And as far as the educated, the most educated people in the country and so on, you belong to that elite just as much as any. What you mean by the elites is left-wing political elites. That's what you mean by the elites. But I don't accept, first of all, this is not a secular country. It is a country in which secularists and people who aren't affiliated with churches are making some gains, but fewer gains than Europe. But if there has been a secularization project in this country, it has been successful only in the media. And it's been successful only in the grossest way in the media. The media is just as piously respectful of religion as every other. The media are, excuse me, just as pious about religion and never have a bad word to say about religious institutions as any other institution. But where the media have been secularized is at the trashiest level, which is what I do a lot of talking about. It has nothing to do with religion, just simply lowest common denominator programs about everything, video games full of violence and all of that. But I wouldn't call that a secularization project. I'd call it the stupidity project.
Yeah, but one of the points you make clear is, though, that a lot of people thought that what you call fundamentalism, a very deep belief, you mentioned biblical
was going
literalism,
to die away.
You make the point that it didn't.
Oh, that's true. that's true. I think that if you had looked at any educated person in, say, 1925 at the time of the Scopes trial, they would have said there won't be any fundamentalists left by the year 2000. And that was wrong, and that's, you know, it was clearly wrong. We do want to talk about the difference between what I call moderate religion.
I want to read to you your own words here. You say the difference between moderate religion and fundamentalism, now as in the past, is that moderate faith attempts to accommodate itself to secular education and secular government. The American religious right rejects both. End quote.
Yes.
Okay.
But
play that out a little
moderate
bit.
Moderate religion, I would expand that and say that moderate religion attempts to accommodate itself to secular knowledge, and that's been true for 200 years. Basically, I don't agree with my friends Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris, by the way, who think that moderate religion is just, quote, just as bad as fundamentalism, but it's the stalking horse for fundamentalism. No, I think moderate religion, beginning actually with geological discoveries in the 18th century, said, okay, let's look at the Bible. Maybe this stuff, maybe we can still believe in God, but not necessarily. We can believe that the 6 days of creation can stand for millions and billions of years, and that God set the process in motion. You know, there are millions of people around the world of different religions who accept both evolution and who believe that God set the process in motion. To me, that's an intellectual position I can't accept. It's a perfectly understandable one. Human beings go around believing contradictory things all the time. It's part of our, you might say it's part of what we're evolutionary hardwired to do.
I really appreciate, by the way, from my perspective, the fact that you do see those things as contradictory. That's something you see. And I appreciate that.
That's
I do too.
I'm not a moderately religious person, but I'm not a religious person at all. But I understand that people believe these things. Look, an example I always give, which I think is very comparable, is, okay, we all know what the divorce rate is in the United States. We all know how many marriages don't last. And yet, I would be willing to believe that nearly everyone who falls in love and enters a marriage is not thinking about those divorce statistics that are out there. They're thinking, I believe in eternal love, and that's what I was going to have. They wouldn't deny that the divorce statistics exist, but when I say that many of us believe many contradictory things, it seems to be a human capacity.
Well, it may be, and we're running out of time here. I just need to very quickly ask you the question that's pressing on my mind, and that is, as you look to the future, what do you see happening? Where do you see America going, in a more religious or in a more secular trajectory?
Well, what we're seeing is a more secular trajectory for, I would say, about half of people. But I don't see, for example, the fundamentalist one-third minority. I don't see that decreasing in size very much. I think that we are going to have a continuation to some degree of viewpoints which secular viewpoints and moderate religious viewpoints are reconcilable in many areas. And in some things, religious and non-religious viewpoints are reconcilable. But as far as the third that says no farther, I won't go there about anything from embryonic stem cell research to any other thing you can name, I don't see that diminishing. But there is also another way you could look at it too, which is if you look at the economic situation we're in, you can say from both a secular and a religious point of view that what has gone on in our economy in terms of fraud and debt and so on is both in a secular sense and in a religious sense highly immoral.
Well, that would be a topic for a different and very fruitful program. Susan Jacoby, I hope you'll come on the program again sometime, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mohler Program. Susan Jacoby's new book, forthcoming from Yale University Press, is Alger Hiss and the Battle for History. I'll be back with final thoughts. You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program. Welcome Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. It was a fascinating discussion with Susan Jacoby. She's gracious and clear and honest. And it's not often that you have the opportunity for the kind of conversation we just had. Time was so fast and fleeting. But I appreciate her honesty. And as she identifies as one who holds to a secularist and atheistic position, she understands what's at stake here. And I think that's one of the achievements of this conversation is that both of us, coming from two diametrically opposed positions on issues of such consequence, we can agree at least on what's at stake. And what I recognize in this is that those who are in some kind of muddled middle are the people who really will not admit the consequences and the scale of the questions with which we have to deal as human beings. Susan Jacoby honestly sees conservative Christians as a part of the problem she documents in her book, The Age of American Unreason. But when I look at it, I realize that this gives us the opportunity to make very clear that we have two opposing worldviews here, and it is possible to think it through consistently as our responsibility. And as a secularist thinks through her worldview consistently, she has to see evangelical Christians as, very much out of step. And she has to understand that we're coming from a very different understanding of meaning from beginning to end. Likewise, Christians need to understand the same. And when I ask her that final question about the direction that America's going, well, that's where, obviously, we have, again, a rather honest acknowledgement of the way each of us, very differently, would want to see this nation go. You know, Susan Jacoby, both in the piece she wrote for the New York Times and in virtually everything else I've seen her write, understands what many other people do not understand, and that is that there is a logic to Christianity, if we really understand the gospel, that means that we have to have, as our concern, seeing persons come to a saving knowledge of faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. She doesn't believe in God. She obviously does not believe in the gospel. But she does believe that Christians must think this way if indeed they are authentically Christian. And on that score, I think she sees it exactly right. We seek to be intelligent Christians, thinking clearly about the issues of the day and the issues of eternity. And when we look at the issues of greatest consequence, sometimes it really helps to be in conversation with someone who comes from a very different point of view to make the issues very, very clear. I'm thankful for the fact she entered this conversation, and it's not every day you have this kind of conversation in Christian radio. But what you have here is an opportunity to think and to realize what's at stake. The only two real alternatives out there I would offer in terms of the question of the existence of God is really the alternative of the Christian faith or of atheism. The consequences of moving in either of these directions of thought cannot be underestimated. It is literally the distinction between one worldview and its opposite. It's good to have a conversation that makes those issues clear, a respectful conversation among persons who both believe that truth, in the end, is what matters. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.